All right. Well, good morning. I'm Pink, and I was just saying to Amber, it's a note to self this morning is don't do a South by Southwest event at 10 o'clock on a Sunday morning of daylight savings time after the opening, after the big night of opening parties. But I'm glad that all of you have weathered your heavy heads and your clock change to come out here to hear about how manga explains the world. Okay, so quick way of introduction. Right now in my life, I write business books. But before I wrote business books, I worked in the equally honorable profession of writing speeches for politicians. And because of that, I have discovered over the years that good speeches, good presentations in general, as Michelle knows, who's worked with before, good speeches in general, and good speeches especially on 10 o'clock on Sunday morning of daylight savings time after an opening night of parties in particular, always have three key ingredients. So there are three key elements, three key ingredients to any good speech, anywhere, anytime. They are brevity, levity, and repetition. All right, let me say that one more time. Brevity, levity, and repetition. So I'm going to try to be reasonably brief, and because we have such a cozy little crowd here, actually there's going to be a tantalizing gift for those of you who remain. I'm actually not joking about that. So I'll try to be brief. I'll try not to be too severe and serious because I am, after all, talking about comics. What I try to do is repeat the important stuff over and 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 over again until you want to scream. That's partly the legacy of a teacher I had in high school named Mrs. Paff, who I have no recollection of anything else she ever said to me. But she did tell us, class, repetition is an effective form of emphasis. Her exact words, I can quote it 30 years later. Repetition is an effective form of emphasis. She told us over and over and over and over. Yes, I can repeat that if you didn't get that. Repetition, so I'm going to try to repeat the important stuff. So here's what I want to do. I want to talk to you about the world of Japanese comics, and not necessarily from an aesthetic perspective, although we might be able to talk about that, but really from a business perspective. Because I think Japanese comics yield two very, very important business lessons for any kind of media industry, especially here in the United States. Two very important lessons. Now, I think the brochure says that there are three lessons. So there are only two. That's partly brevity. If you want, the first lesson, I was thinking, oh, good God, it's like they said three lessons and now I only have two. So I think the first lesson is going to be no one talks about Fight Club. So for the three of you who got that, thank you. Alrighty, we're going to talk about Japanese comics. Now, here's what happened last year. My family and I have three children, one wife. We all went to Tokyo. We spent a couple of months in Tokyo. I was there on a fellowship, and I was there on a fellowship to study the manga industry. And again, these two sort of takeaways for business I gleaned during this fellowship, spending a couple of months in Tokyo, talking to manga artists, talking to manga publishers, talking to manga fans. And so I want to give you a very quick overview of, very, very quick overview of manga in Japan to give you the really salient things, and then talk about these business lessons that I think that they yield. One of the most important things to understand about manga in Japan, in contrast to comics here, is just how ubiquitous they are in Japan. It is astonishing. If you go into a convenience store, a 7-Eleven type store in Japan, you will see towers of magazines like this, these weekly comic magazines. The ubiquity in Japan, these thick magazines. I mean, this is Weekly Shonen Jump. Okay, this is a weekly. It comes out every single week. I mean, it's as thick as thicker than the Sheboygan, Wisconsin phone book. It's probably the size of the Baltimore phone book every single week. And this is just one of many. So you see them in piles and piles and piles, these weekly comic magazines. You also go to a bookstore and you just see acres of these, the novelizations of these things, basically these serialized comics reprinted into paperback books. So it is ubiquitous in a way that is kind of staggering by American standards. Staggering by American standards. It is, I actually tried this in Tokyo, tried to walk more than basically two blocks in Tokyo without seeing manga. And it's almost impossible because of the convenience stores, the bookstores, people walking around with it. You see it, you know, you see it on the subway, in Tokyo and elsewhere. You know, adults reading these comics. And this guy wondering why I'm taking this picture, but that's another story. In a way that you don't. I live in Washington, D.C., if you were to go onto the Washington Metro or the New York subway and see a grown-up reading a comic, you would think, oh my God, what a loser. I mean, he's probably on a way to some Dungeons, no offense, some Dungeons and Dragons conference or something. But it, here in Japan, it's more or less ubiquitous. You really see it everywhere. Like this guy, who's so into manga, he's about to get hit by a bus. So that's actually one of the important things to understand as I sort of get to these business lessons that it yields. Let's talk about the math. 22% of printed material in Japan is in manga. So think about that for a moment. Basically, one out of every four printed pages is in this comic form. It's extraordinary, just the ubiquity. That's the most important thing to understand. Now, the second thing that I think is important to understand that I saw as and again, I'm looking at this as a foreigner going to study this, you know, a culture where I had an interpreter but didn't speak the language, where I'm seeing things very much with fresh eyes. So these are the sort of really salient takeaways of a foreigner looking at this country with fresh eyes. Is number one, the ubiquity. It is astonishing by American standards. The other thing on ubiquity is that if we think about Japanese pop culture, which is having an influence around the world. I mean, 10 years ago, maybe 15 years ago, if you had a panel at South by Southwest on manga, people wouldn't know what you were talking about. You still have, when I mentioned that I went to study manga, people don't know what it is, in the United States, oftentimes. And the point here is that if you look at the pop culture in Japan and the influence that Japanese pop culture has had here on cartoons, on figures, on games, on the vernacular, on young Americans sort of embracing this form of expression. What's important to understand and what I realized going to Japan is that manga sits at the center of all of it. The entire vaunted Japanese pop culture apparatus is keyed on manga, that Japanese pop culture is really a manga industrial complex. So you have manga, so you have these manga at the center. Manga is what births anime. All the 80%, roughly 85%, give or take, of the animated films, the anime, begin as manga. If you look at figures, there's a huge business in figures. Many of the figures begin as manga. If you look at games, large number of the games, another huge industry, begin as manga. If you look at went to a television station in Osaka as part of a kind of this ceremonial visit for part of my fellowship, and I was talking to the head of the CEO of this TV station, this basically this sort of mini network in central Japan, and he was surprised that an American would come all the way across the oceans to spend a couple of months reading comic books. But then he stopped and said, I think about our TV programming, when you trace it back, huge numbers of it start as manga. Even something like retail, to some extent, has a foot in manga. And so, if you think about Japanese pop culture, manga is really at the center of it. These comics are really at the center of it, and to some extent, these weekly comic magazines are at the center of it. Now, here's what's interesting. So you have this ubiquity. You have this ubiquity in Japan. But you also have manga basically in decline. That is, you have the whole industry very concerned about its drop. That is, it's reached sort of, there's a sense almost like kind of Hollywood to some extent, or network television in the United States, that as saturated as it has become, it's in decline. And if you look at the numbers, there's kind of this inexorable slow decline in the circulation of these magazines, in the purchase of some of these, in some of these books. And so the first point I want to tell you about in terms of what one can learn from manga is that the way that they've chosen, or the very kind of quiet seemingly passive way that some people in the industry have chosen to deal with this decline offer some hints about what I think American media companies can do to deal with their decline. And here's how I want to explain it. That's my first point. C1, my first point. There are these keynote PowerPoint presentation consultants out there. I mean, it's amazing, job category, if you think about it. And one of them saw something that I did, and he said, you do a lot of lists, so what you should do is, you should put the numbers in really, really big. So if you have, and I do that, and each time, I wonder why I do it. The first point, has to do with how you revive an industry in decline. And this is very, very curious, and it begins here. About a month into my trip, I went to a comic market. Now, this comic market is not quite like a Comic-Con in the United States. This comic market, first of all, it's, as you can see here, it's thronged with people. Tens upon tens upon tens of thousands of people flooding to a place called Tokyo Big Sight in search of manga. It's incredible. I mean, they actually had to prohibit people from sleeping outside the night before. There are all these kind of rules to maintain some semblance of order in what's already a very orderly society. And so the idea that you're imposing rules of order on what's, I think, sort of this intrinsically very orderly society is interesting in and of itself. But throngs of people this is what the scene looks like very much. Huge numbers of people pouring in there because they love manga, they want to buy manga. Now, what's interesting, though, is that the manga that they're buying isn't professional manga. It's not the manga, it's not these weekly comic magazines, it's not these, books that are ubiquitous. They're not buying official mainstream manga. What they're buying is something called doujinshi. Nope. So something called... from now on, I'm only putting numbers up there. is something called doujinshi, which is basically amateur manga, fan-created manga. Now, think about that for a moment here. Here's what I want you to try to imagine. Imagine a convention center this size, the size of the Austin Convention Center here, and imagine a comic conference. Imagine more people than come to South by Southwest. I mean, maybe 30, 40, 50,000 people coming in to a convention center like this, swarming through the doors to buy comics. But they're not buying, in the American sense, they're not buying Superman, they're not buying Captain America, they're not buying Batman, they're not buying the conventional kind of comics. They're buying comics created by civilians, created by amateurs. Now that's pretty amazing in and of itself. And you see this catalog here. Let me show this catalog here for a second, these amateur creators are known as circles, doujinshi circles. And you have, again, another phone book of all the circles that are displaying their wares at this thing. So just imagine filling this convention center with tables of amateurs, people from, imagine people from Dallas or Phoenix or Sheboygan, Wisconsin, coming here, setting up a little table by the tens and tens of thousands and selling their home-brewed manga, their home-brewed comics. Now, that's pretty interesting in and of itself. And the fact that these folks are flooding in to buy it is kind of interesting in and of itself because they're not buying the official commercial manga. Now, here's what's also interesting about it. Way back when, I went to law school. And now, I never practiced law. I didn't do very well in law school. In fact, I graduated in the part of my class that made the top 90% possible. So that's one reason why I didn't never practice law. But I did dramatically increase my earning power by going to law school because I met my wife. And my wife, my wife actually did practice law for a while. And my wife actually has a very, very acute legal, she no longer practices law. She has a very, very acute legal sense. And in some of the work, we now, in our little own operation, she does a lot of the intellectual property work. And I thought about my wife, if she had, say my wife had not met me, she, and she might have gone on to become like a, you know, the general counsel of Disney or some intellectual property law firm because she's into it and it's interesting. If an American intellectual property lawyer, my wife or somebody else, walked in there and saw what was going on, they would faint. They would collapse. Why? Because this homebrewed manga is taking characters from existing manga and remixing them. Taking characters that are copyright protected, putting them in new scenarios. Taking characters that are copyright protected, mixing them up in a whole different set of ways. An American copyright lawyer truly, truly, honestly would hit the floor in disbelief. Imagine that. Imagine this right now. Imagine, so let me show you what some of the things that they're doing here. Where's this? Okay, I'll give you one example. One kind of genre of it is, there's a well-known manga series that's popular in the United States now called Bleach. Okay? Bleach has these two characters, Ichigo and I think, what's the other one? Ruika? Yeah. Man and a woman, young man and a young woman, and they have this very kind of chaste relationship in the story. Well, some fans, you know where this is going. Some fans think the relationship is not so chaste. That in off the pages, in this alternative universe out there, these two folks are hooking up. And so they said, I want to tell that story. So here it is, for sale. In explicit, very explicit terms. Let me show you, and it's not all pornographic, but there's a lot of it is. Here is, but it's not. Okay, so let's take a look at this. Here's a well-known manga collective called Clamp, insanely popular in the United States. I managed to get an interview with the creators here, and it was like, I mean, it's as a journalist, it's sort of like getting an interview with someone like Clamp is akin to getting an interview with, like, you know, Gwyneth Paltrow or something like that. I mean, you have to go through layers and layers of handlers, and I mean, but this is a series called Card Captor Sakura, about a little girl who goes to a, she finds a book, and the book has these cards, and anyway, complications ensue. I don't particularly like it. I have two daughters. My daughters kind of think it's cool. You go to the comic market, and here you have something that I would never under any circumstances want my daughters to see, which is the Sakura remix, where she begins to discover all other kinds of things about how the world works. she encounters a strangely amorous frog. She is in a classroom and there's a hidden camera recording all kinds of things that typically don't go on in a classroom. Let me show you another example of this. Again, I'm showing you, it's not all pornographic, it's not all extreme. Let me show you another one. So I see this young woman sitting at a table selling her wares, and she has this thing here. Now she's selling this and this, and it's about a character named Chibi Maruku-chan. Chibi Maruku-chan is sort of like, in American terms, would be kind of Sally from Peanuts with a little bit of Lisa Simpson. Sort of that, but the point here is that she's a character well known among kids, but like a lot of comic characters, never grows up. Like Sally. I mean, Sally has been, what, 6 years old for, you know, six decades. All right, never grows up. So this young woman said, you know what, I read Chibi Maruku-chan when I was a kid. I've always wondered what would happen when Chibi Maruku-chan grew up, when she went from a girl to a woman. And so I decided to do it. And so she's out there selling this story, brilliantly rendered. I mean, the art in these things is extraordinary. The art in these things is, in some ways, indistinguishable from the underlying works. She's out there selling stories about Chibi Maruku-chan becoming a woman, discovering the things that women apparently discover. Now, think about that for a moment. Just think about that for a moment. Think about if, you know, you had this giant convention here at this convention center, and you had tens of thousands of fans coming in, and you had these great unwashed creators who were basically ripping off characters that are copyrighted and remixing them and putting them into some kind of compromising situations. Imagine, you know, Disney, if you had a, there's a genre of manga in Japan called yaoi, which is boy love. About two men falling, usually kind of very handsome, very androgynous men falling in love and doing those sorts of things. And imagine if you had a convention here with tens of thousands of people, and there are tables and tables of people devoted to selling stories about Mickey Mouse falling in love with Goofy. Now, what would you think Disney's response would be? That also reminds me of a very funny joke. Do you know, you guys know that joke? It's a sort of off-color joke, so. you never heard that joke about Goofy and Mickey? Oh, it's a good joke. It's not color, and I actually don't do blue material. I never do blue material.
Now you have to say it.
But now I have to say it, but I'm going to cover up the microphone. Mickey and Minnie are getting... You haven't heard this joke? Mickey and Minnie are getting a divorce? You really haven't heard it? Mickey and Minnie are... Maybe, though. Mickey and Minnie are getting a divorce.
Not since you're alive.
Mickey and Minnie, you went to a very progressive junior high. I didn't hear it until I was 40. Mickey and Minnie are getting a divorce, and they go to the court, and the judge says, So, Mr. Mouse, you want to divorce Minnie Mouse because you say she's insane. And he says, I didn't say she was insane, I said she was fucking goofy. Okay, we're back here. This is the Samantha Power approach to presentations, going off the record in a completely meaningless way. But think about that. Think about that for a moment. Think about those kinds of things being for sale. Disney, when that Disney lawyer picked himself or herself off the ground, got the smelling salts, and they would have thumbed a cease and desist order on their BlackBerry like this. But they're not shutting it down. So I'm amazed as a Westerner, as someone with a modicum of legal training, I'm amazed that this is going on. So I start exploring what's going on, and I keep hearing this word. I keep hearing this phrase in Japanese. Anmoku no ryokai. Anmoku no ryokai. Which means basically implicit agreement. Implicit agreement. Or, tacit pact. I like implicit agreement. And basically what happened is that you look at the organizers and you even talk to the publishers, and they say, you know what? Publishers, we're kind of sort of looking the other way. We're kind of sort of looking the other way. Yeah, this is clearly a violation of copyright. There's no question about it. It's not even a close call. But we're going to kind of look the other way. And the creators say, well, if they're looking the other way, what I'm going to do is not make too much money off of it. And most of them don't make much money at all. Most of them are really doing it for love, not money. And so they say, we're not going to go too far. We'll print 3,000 copies or 2,000 copies. We're not going to make massive amounts of money off of it. Now, that's kind of interesting, isn't it? You have basically this implicit agreement among the creators and the fans to trample copyright law. And I think that this offers us some hints that you have the manga industry declining in Japan, and they're looking for ways to rehabilitate it. And they say, wait a second, there actually might be an advantage of letting these fans trample all over copyright. There might be an advantage in having these fans take our proprietary characters and remix them, even though they're doing some things that we never want kids to see, even though they're doing some things that we might not endorse. And yet, we can't say that. And yet, we're not talking about changing copyright law. And yet, we're not talking about, say, doing a Creative Commons license and sort of giving people those rights. There's no way the publishers are ever going to do that. But let's just kind of sort of see how it works. And so what you have is you have this way of trying to revive this part of the industry, which is dying, by doing this kind of extra legal implicit agreement on Noku no Ryokai. Now, what's interesting about that is that it suggests analytically that the copyright, and this is basically, in some ways, a verification, a validation of a lot of the things that Larry Lessig has said about the inadequacies of copyright law. Copyright law was built for what he calls a read-only culture. All right. Now, that makes a lot of sense. If I were to take the official version, if I were to take Cardcaptor Sakura and take it down to Kinko's and photocopy it and then sell it for cheaper, that would be bad. That would be bad morally, but it would also be bad economically. It'd be unfair because basically what I would be doing is I'd be ripping these people off. I wouldn't be adding anything to them, and I also wouldn't be doing anything original. I wouldn't be doing anything original. It's pure piracy. So copyright laws are written for this read-only culture. However, more and more, as all of you know, this has become very much a read-write culture, where people take things and remix them and make them their own. Now, on that, there definitely is a level of originality. There's no question that what these folks are doing here is, in some ways, spectacularly original. What they're doing is that not only in terms of the execution of the art, but also in terms of the stories themselves. Because what they're saying is that when I see a character, when I see a story, I recognize I'm only, it's like meeting a person. And when I meet a person or know a person, I know that I only understand one part of that person's life. That person has another life elsewhere that I don't typically see. And I think it's true with these characters too, and I want to reveal that. Because I think I know what's going on. I think these two are hooking up off the page somewhere. I think that this one character is having problems with his mother. I think this other guy is secretly depressed. Even though he's, a robust, strong figure on the page. And so there's huge amounts of originality there. And so, unlike Xeroxing Cardcaptor Sakura. The other thing, though, is that there's an increasing recognition that this is actually good for the creators themselves, good for the copyright holders themselves. And this is really, really weird in a legal sense, because the copyright, let's think about environmental laws. We have environmental law. I feel like I'm sort of returning to law school here. I'm having dark, horrid flashbacks here. Let's think about environmental laws. Environmental laws exist to protect the public interest. That is, we impose certain regulations on things, so we don't want people, companies polluting, and that's for the public interest. But copyright law is not necessarily only for that. Copyright law is about protecting the commercial interests of the creator, to make sure that they don't get ripped off. But what's happening here is that those copyright laws, in some ways, are actually hindering them. Because you can make a very good case that these fans who are swarming in, when you have 30, 40,000 fans swarming in, not to buy official manga, which is in decline, but to buy this doujinshi remixed fan manga. It's like, that should tell you something. That's actually a good thing. That can help revive the industry, except that the legal regime is inadequate to deal with that. And so what you have is you have this completely spooky, unspoken kind of agreement, where there's this kind of implicit pact where publishers look the other way and the creators don't go too far. Now, there are a couple of interesting things about this, and again, it just totally blows your mind from an American perspective, an American legalist perspective. So, there's a store in Japan. There are many stores in Japan. We're leaving the comic markets and we're going to the retail stores. You can go into certain retail stores and buy. Well, let me give you an example. You can go into a store, a bookstore, as I did with these, literally with these. At least with this one, and you can buy a copy of Clamp, and then in the same store, not in the same shelf, but in the same store, but literally like as far away as that back wall there. So I buy the official Clamp here, and you can go and buy a remix copyright busting copy 20 meters away. Now think about that. Think about that in the United States. Think about just how unlikely it would be to walk into a Barnes & Noble and say, hey, I'm going to pick up a copy of the latest Harry Potter. Oh, and then I'm going to pick up, Michelle's remix version of, Mrs. McGonagall and Hermione falling in love. I mean, it's inconceivable, but it's conceivable. Just think about that for a moment. You can buy in the same store the official version and the knocked-off, copyright, slightly pornographic remix version in the same store, just 20 meters away. Now, and it's all because, now what's going on is that, again, no one's saying anything about this. They're basically doing this, you know, all implicitly. But what, if you go and actually talk to some of the people, as I did one of the retailers, he drew a chart for me, and I want to show you this chart. I redid it. I want to show you a chart that he did for me. He said, basically, what you have, think about the manga business, or think about any, and here's the thing, we're going to extend it to any creative business. Think about any media creative business. At the top, you have the artists, okay? And these manga artists, the professional manga artists, are extremely well-paid, extremely well-known in Japan. Down here, you have readers. Down here, you have readers. And typically, we tend to think it's like this and that, and that's it. But what he's saying is that these doujinshi come in, and they actually serve as this kind of connective tissue between the two. Because these folks are readers and artists. They're senders and receivers. And that as a result of this, in this world where the doujinshi have more power, where amateurs have a lot more power, that this part of the triangle here keeps it alive. And that you need this to keep the entire industry alive. And yet, the copyright laws, the legal regime, is inadequate to do this, so we have to kind of do it off the books. Fascinating tale. Then, so this is, I think, offers some lessons on how declining American media industries can actually do this. And what you hear is that you actually hear a very hard-headed business case here, because this Annoko no Ryokai isn't just kind of this wacky little thing, it's basically a business model. It's basically a business model designed to kind of retrofit a business model on an inadequate legal regime. Here's what if you talk to folks, sorry, spazzing out here a little bit. If you talk to people, they say, listen, it's very clear that there are three advantages to this Annoko no Ryokai arrangement. Three very clear business advantages to this regime where we give fans huge amounts of power. Number one, customer care. These folks who take a day off of work, who, you know, have to be stopped from waiting outside, who race in and spend, you know, sometimes hundreds and hundreds of dollars on this amateur manga. Those are people, if you're in the manga industry, you kind of like. Those are hardcore fans. Those are serious folks. And so you don't, and the publishers say, you know, these folks are not only buying the doujinshi, they're buying the underlying works. They're so into the underlying works, they're so into the characters and the stories and the underlying works, that they also want to know what happens next. They also want to know what's happening off the page. So why would we want to just kind of, you know, come in with our jackboots and stomp through these things and shut it down? We'd anger our most valuable customers. So that's one. And that makes perfect sense. The other two are actually somewhat, I think, slightly more intriguing. Number one. Number two. And you see this happening in YouTube. It's a talent market. And so what happens is that you now have publishers quietly trolling these amateur comic markets, looking for the real great creators, looking for the ones who are really popular. And some of these amateur creators, there are a few of them, no joke, there are a few of them that had lines of fans waiting to buy stuff in the thousands for their own amateur work. Whoa. Wait a second. Here's someone with a proven fan appeal. Here's someone who's doing great work. We can use this as a talent market. And what's interesting is that Clamp, over here, here's Clamp, which is a pretty popular in the United States, actually. Insanely popular in Japan. It's four women. They started as a doujinshi circle and got discovered. They started out by remixing this ridiculously cheesy series about a soccer team called, Captain Tsubasa. Is that right? Yeah, Captain Tsubasa. They started out as a doujinshi circle, kind of got discovered, and used that as their launching point. So it operates as a talent market. The other thing that it does for these publishers is that it's free market research. And so what happens is that you can begin divining trends of where the market is going by looking at what's popular. So here's an example. The doujinshi circles for Full Metal Alchemist, which is a series some of you might know. It's popular in the United States. And a lot of it is this yaoi, this kind of yaoi love stories about these two guys falling in love. There were, Full Metal Alchemist, 1,100 doujinshi circles doing remixed versions of Full Metal Alchemist. That's kind of interesting. Now, the other thing that they do, the publishers will tell you, again, kind of off the record, we don't really like talking about this. Can you not write this down explicitly? I don't know. You can look at these comic markets for where the trends are going. Example. The publisher of Bleach, very popular series again here in the US too, knew something was going on and that they had a pretty popular series on their hand when there's a series, a manga series in Japan called Prince of Tennis. When the Prince of Tennis doujinshi circles said, yeah, we're kind of sick of Prince of Tennis. We're going to become Bleach circles. And they kind of, and the Prince of Tennis publishers say, oh God, this is like the canary in the coal mine. Now I know some of you, a handful of you would say Prince of Tennis will never die. Okay, fair point. But that gives you, so that's free market research. And so these but again, the laws are inadequate to deal with this, so you have this tacit arrangement. And I think that increasingly you could see that here in the United States, except that the media companies are very, very legalistic. They're staffed by a lot of lawyers who want to justify their jobs. But this Omnoku no Ryokai is actually a very potent business model for reviving industries that are on the decline. So that's the first thing I want to tell you about manga. The second thing, indicated by the 2 and 400 point type, so we're talking about how do you revive an industry that's declining. And I think this Omnoku no Ryokai arrangement is actually a really fascinating way with a lot of really good lessons for American media. The second thing I want to talk about is how do you take a genre like manga, which is popular in the United States, but just at this point. In Japan, it's going down like this. In the United States, it's ticking up ever more if you go to, also around the world. And I think there's a strategy here too that offers a lot of opportunities. And there's Chris. So, I mean, Chris, and you'll see, I'll sort of validate your theory here in a second about sort of different ways to use this. If you look at the international popularity, it's quite amazing. So here you have, a title in, the UK, which is the manga version of Romeo and Juliet, using Shakespeare's language, but telling the story about these two families in Tokyo. And there's another manga Shakespeare series coming out in the U.S. in April. If you look at a place like France, which has a comic tradition called bande dessinée, which is much more kind of painterly, slower-moving kind of comics, you see something almost would have been unheard of in Paris not too long ago. I took this photo a couple months ago, which is basically a manga cafe in Paris, where you have shelves upon shelves and upon shelves of Japanese manga. If you look at it in the United States, you see a huge increase in manga sales in the United States when, as I know, you know, as I contend with as a creator myself, the rest of the publishing industry is basically flatlining. That is, almost every category of books is flatlining, if not sinking. But manga is the one category that is ticking up. And if you go into a typical chain bookstore, Barnes & Noble, Borders, you will see a manga section that is very large. You will see a manga section that is larger today than it was 6 months ago and than it was a year ago. And so I think that if you think about how do you get an industry to arrest its decline, I think there's some hints of how you get an industry to tick back up, or to take a fledgling industry in this country and tick it back up. Because again, manga has become insanely popular, very popular in the United States. Wired, for whom I write, declare that manga is conquering America. Now, the problem is that there's a missing genre here. And this is how. We have a very kind of, narrow view of comics and what comics are for. And Japan offers us some hints about that. In Japan, you can find all kinds of manga like this. Let me show you some examples. Manga for adults. Salaryman. There's a genre called salaryman manga, which is exemplified by this guy here, Kosaku Shima, who is been a series that's gone on for, I don't know, probably 15, even 20 years now, about this guy who slowly rises through the ranks of a company. And believe me, seven-year-olds are not reading this. But salary men are reading it, and I love this series. I think this series totally rocks. I do. I love it. I mean, it's weird to tell a Japanese person that, because it's like, what would be the analogy in the United States? It's like having a Japanese person come to you and say, man, everyone loves Raymond. It's so good. You know, it's like, whoa. You know, I mean, it's that, you know what I mean? It's like that kind of thing. I had to stop saying it, because it's like, you know, I'd say that, oh, I love Kosakushima. Like, oh, really? Huh. Kodansha has a bilingual version of it, which actually helped me learn hiragana and katakana. But it's a great series, but it's for adults. But you also see other things. You see bigger nonfiction manga for adults. So you have this thing here, which is here's a political tract, basically a tract about nationalism, the dangers of nationalism. Okay? Boy, there's, you know, how about this? How about how many pages? Here. Anybody want to read a 268-page book about nationalism? You know, that's a room emptier, all right? But hey, let's do it in manga form. And it ends up being very popular because it's quicker, it's more accessible. So you have even a serious issue like that being rendered in manga. Okay, we don't have that tradition here in the United States. You have Osamu Tezuka, who is the, you know, the god of manga, basically the guy who started the whole thing. I mean, he's basically, in Japanese terms, Osamu Tezuka, who essentially the god of manga, in some sense the founder of manga. His role in Japanese manga is kind of Walt Disney meets Elvis meets Thomas Edison. I mean, it's like that degree of cultural impact. And so he has a series that gives you the history of Buddha. This is translated into English. You know, the history of Buddha in manga. Okay? It's kind of interesting. Here we go with some, let's talk about some business titles. Here's a guide to time management. Okay? Time management, hey, you don't have a lot of time, obviously. So let's do it in this quick, ultra-quick, accessible form, and let's have Kosakushima be the star, because all the nerds will buy it. All right, so there's that. You have this title, which was extremely popular, translated into the United States, which is basically, you know, it's actually a nice period piece right now, which is called Japan Inc., which was, in the 1980s, a story about Japan's rise. Like, what? How do you understand the Japanese economic behemoth? Well, here's a manga to explain that. To my mind, that can help actually this one area of books, which is on the upswing, get even more on the upswing, because I feel like we're missing an entire genre here in the United States. We don't have this genre of manga for adults, manga that is on economics or on business or on nationalism or on any of these kinds of nonfiction titles. To my mind, again, as a foreigner looking at the Japanese market, I say, wait a second, it's kind of like, imagine if you have the medium of film, and Japan's making romantic comedies, and we weren't making romantic comedies. You'd say, maybe we should make romantic comedies. I mean, it's not that tough of an analytic problem. I think there's a huge missing genre of manga in the United States that can help the book business in general and the comic business in particular really rise by reaching an entirely new audience, basically people over 17. And so what I have tried to do, basically act on this principle and create the first business book in manga for a Western audience, which comes out in April. It's this book right here called The Adventures of Johnny Bunko, The Last Career Guide You'll Ever Need. I want to show you some of the pages, and because of your dedication coming out early on a Sunday morning, I actually will have copies of it for all of you who stay to the end. No, but I want to, and you know what? No one else has copies of this yet, so it's really actually an exciting moment for all of us. But let me show you what it looks like. Let me show you what it looks like, because I'm basically saying, okay, if you're right, let's give it a whirl. If you're right that there's a whole missing genre, let's give it a try. Let's go out of your kind of, you know, prose books, P-R-O-S-E books, and do something that is actually more in tune with the times. It might actually have a moment. So it tells us, so it's a career guide, all graphic novel. I did it with a manga artist named, American manga artist named Rob Tenpass, whose name we put in very small type right there. here's what he looks like. An actual photograph of, he's an insanely talented American manga artist. There are many, many young American manga artists now. It's actually really quite fascinating how many young Americans there are in art and design programs and illustration programs, even just in their basements or attics, doing some really, really cool manga and actually inflecting it with a different, with a kind of an American perspective. Not simply aping Japanese manga, but actually bringing to bear sort of an American cultural perspective on it. Rob is one of the very, 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 very best. He won the Tokyo Pop, big manga publisher, Tokyo Pop's Rising Stars of Manga competition, which is, you know, basically the American Idol of manga. And there he is. So this book tells the story of a guy named Johnny Bunko, who works at a place called the Boggs Corporation. So you see, he's a lot like you and me. He's a good person, basically. He's kind to animals, helps old ladies across the street. He studied fairly hard in school. You see this parade of B pluses. Got pretty good grades, listened to his parents and teachers, set off on his career. He did what everyone said he was supposed to do. The thing is, he's begun to suspect that everyone was wrong. So one night, Johnny has a dark night of the soul. He's working late at his office. He gets some takeout Japanese food. And he goes to eat it, and he opens up these chopsticks. And boom, you have this explosion that these chopsticks trigger. And as you see here, we've done, this is a whole top, whole other really cool, interesting topic is the world of Japanese sound effects in manga. So we have actually all the sound effects are in Japanese. We not translated. So this is paka, which is the sound of paka, the sound of chopsticks snapping open. Now you don't necessarily, I mean, I'm guessing that 99.5% of the readers of this book will not, you know, have their, you know, katakana dictionary next to them, but I don't think you need it. And so his chopsticks break open, they trigger an explosion, and it unleashes a character that I think is unprecedented in Western literature, a character named Diana, who is kind of part I Dream of Jeannie, part Cameron Diaz, kind of a kick-ass career advisor. And she proceeds to tell Johnny the really important lessons of a satisfying, productive career. That's a cool image. I mean, you don't need to know what that says in order to understand what it means. So she teaches him these lessons, and so, but Johnny, the thing is, here's the thing, folks, Johnny only has 6 chopsticks, so he has to use them judiciously, because every time he breaks them open, see, paka, Diana appears and, you know, trash talks him and helps him navigate the world of work at Boggs and elsewhere. And it ends up yielding these 6 lessons about the world of work. 6 kind of big picture lessons about how to succeed in the workplace. And so she tells him here, I mean, this is, you know, lesson number 1 that Johnny learns is there is no plan. I've talked to a lot of college students in the last couple of years about my other books, and they inevitably end up asking me career questions. And the career question inevitably ends up being, well, Dan, here's what I want to do. I'm majoring in this. And then when I graduate, I'm going to work for this place for 2 years. And then after that, I'm going to go here. And then I'm going to go to graduate school. And after that, I'm going to go here and do that for 3 years. And then I'm going to go here. And I just say to them, listen, take it from an old man like me. There is no plan. It doesn't work that way. And anybody who's actually done anything, I think, of consequence, most people who've done anything of consequence haven't had a plan. And that's actually been advantageous. So number 1 is there is no plan, which Johnny tells him. He, of course, has it being commercial fiction. He, of course, has sidekicks like Yuko, Carlos, Dave. He has 2 bosses, the cool boss, Lakshmi, and the bad boss, who's simply known as the boss. And it also has some other things that I think you will not see in any other form of literature. Give you a tantalizing preview of them here. A bobblehead doll of Martin Seligman of the University of Pennsylvania. A bobblehead doll of Marcus Buckingham of Now Discover Your Strengths fame. Something called the Casino of Human Accomplishment that Diana takes them to, where you actually bet on people. that has a surprise. So you see, so she says, second question, what's the most, she's asking these questions, what's the most powerful force in the universe? And Carlos says, love. And she says, ugh, Al. And so he says, compound interest. And she says, nice guess, Einstein. And so they go to this casino. It also has something that is truly, truly unprecedented, which is, to my mind, in actually the history not only of comics, but the history of book-based art, is the world's first only two-page spread devoted to Excel. Let me take 2 minutes to tell you the sort of the underlying business theory here, the underlying theory of this book. Here's what I think. It's not only a way to expand the category, but it's also of why the category is expandable, because it does something that's different. Think about career books for a second. There are two kinds of information that people want in their careers. Tactical information and strategic information. Okay? The tactical information, how to write a resume, what questions to ask in interviews, what to wear in an interview, that sort of stuff. The sad fact is, for those of us who are writers of books, people get that stuff online. People get tactical information online. And tactical information that's in a book basically becomes outdated immediately. So there's, in terms of career or business books, tactical information in book-based form is useless. But what people want from books, I think, are what they can't get from Google, which is strategic advice, big picture advice, the sorts of things that I, as a 40-something, can tell somebody who's in their early 20s, saying, I'll tell you what, here's what I wish I knew when I was starting out in the workforce 25 years ago. Big picture, strategic advice. But they want it in a quick, accessible, easy to read, fun form. So this book, you can actually read in an hour, cost about the same as a movie ticket. Here's what I think is going on, and I'll wrap up on this. I think there's a certain question animating the world of work today. In the 1970s and 80s, the question that animated work was, what color is your parachute? In the 1990s, the era of downsizing and whatnot, the reigning question of work was, who moved my cheese? Now I think, if you think about the first decade of the 21st century, I think there's a new question at the center of work, a new question that people at work are asking themselves, a new question that I think is keeping people up at night, a new question that people are wrestling with every day. And that question is this. That's the question this book seeks to answer in a fun, accessible way. And it is my absolute delight to be able to give all of you copies of it right now. Thanks for your time. I think, Andrew, we're out of time, right? Do we have any time for questions? 4 minutes? Oh, we have 4 minutes, which means that we have, for me, that's actually like half an answer. I'll happily take any questions that you might have, and also I'm putting up my email address if you want to ask them offline. Meantime, you want to help me pass out some books?
Delegate.
So, I hope you like it. I think it's kind of cool. You should be able to read it fast. Any questions out there in question land? Yes, coming up to the microphone.
Professor Schlesinger at Harvard decades ago tried to explain Japan by saying they were a conformist and a collectivist society because it was a small island without much agrarian land. He later was the ambassador to Japan in the Kennedy administration, right? So does the intermediate derivative unauthorized winked at market apply to markets where you don't have that unique culture? Will it port to the U.S. or other markets?
That's actually a really interesting question. And the real answer to that is, in some ways, we'll see. I mean, I think that some American creators, some American media firms are going to give this a whirl. And we'll see whether their lawyers go into coronary arrest. We'll see whether it actually works. I think in some ways it's kind of interesting that you see it in Japan because In some ways, Japanese culture is moving in the other way. Japanese culture has built in some ways on this kind of notion of unspoken things. And as things get globalized more, you want to impose kind of more explicit legal regimes on things. And so this is actually in a way of basically resisting that. So it's an interesting question. I don't know the answer, but the real answer is we'll see. Yes.
I'm wondering about the differences in American and Japanese education. I grew up in the years where you couldn't read Classics Illustrated for your book report. And comics were just they were a denigrated medium. And there are a lot of good reasons why. But now, I mean, I'm finding that I get the best history lesson from Larry Gonick's History of the Universe. And the beginner's series that's half comic, half prose, beginner's introduction to Plato, Socrates.
Yeah.
So what's going on in our educational, or maybe even our approach to our appreciation of, are we a word-fascinated language rather than image?
Well, it's a really, really interesting, that's another really interesting question. I think one of the things that you see about manga, one of the things if you talk to manga critics as I do, as I did in Japan, is that they will say that manga is not words plus pictures or pictures plus words, but this kind of synergistic combination of the two. And that's what makes it work. And I think there's some evidence that that actually is a powerful form here in the United States. So you mentioned the Gopnik book, Howard Zinn, the American historian, has a graphic novel coming out, a graphic nonfiction coming out, in April. If you look at most revealing nonfiction books I've read, I recommend to you a graphic novel called Persepolis, which is about a young woman in revolutionary Iran who ends up, basically being smuggled out of the country. Great insight into what's going on in Iran. There's a Canadian guy who spent some time in North Korea, wrote a graphic memoir called Pyongyang, gives you a brilliant picture of what's happening in North Korea. So I think that there's a recognition that this is a legitimate form of expression. And if you see in the United States, the curious thing is that graphic novels themselves end up being fairly literary. That we don't, I mean, to me, it's like the lowbrow side is in some ways missing. And so I think, there's typically more money in lowbrow than in highbrow, at least I'm hoping. So I do think that there's something going on out there that recognizes this as a legitimate form of expression. And I think part of it has to do with the accessibility of basic information on the internet, and that books no longer serve that function. And so they have to serve a different function. And the function can be more cinematic, more artistic, more about the narrative, more about the experience. Thank you. Amber says we have to wrap up. I'm happy to talk a little bit more afterwards outside so we get out of this room. There's my email address. Anybody not get a book? I'll give you a book. Thanks.